lesson that the plagues and what God did to Egypt was for one express purpose. It wasn't just to free the Israelites. God could have done that any old way. But it was for the express purpose of the Egyptians knowing that He was God. You know, He said, they are going to know that I am God. You know, God is going to teach us things, isn't He? And we can either learn it the easy way or we can learn it the hard way, but we're going to learn it. Everybody's going to be a believer. You can either believe the easy way and find salvation, or you can believe the hard way, but every knee will bow and every tongue will confess one day. So everybody's on their way to believing. It's just which route are you taking? And you know, the Egyptians learned the hard way. I don't know if I told y'all this before, but we were playing a game back, I think at Thanksgiving. At the Thanksgiving, we were playing Catan back there, and Tom was playing with me and Jonah and some others, and Jonah did some kind of move to Tom that was really mean, just really got him good. And I said, boy, Tom, you're having to learn the hard way. And Jonah went, that's the only way to learn. But, you know, while it may apply in some cases, you don't want it to apply as you're dealing with God. You'd rather learn the easy way than the hard. Well, after passing through the Red Sea and the Egyptian army being destroyed, Israel departed Egypt and continued on. And the Israelites began their journey through the Sinai Peninsula. Now, they could have taken the much shorter route, the northern route that went along the Mediterranean Sea. It was a route that only was about 200 miles. They could have made that journey in about 2 weeks and been in the land of Canaan fairly quickly. But that is not the route they took. They're going to take a route into southern Sinai, and they are going to go to a mountain called Mount Sinai. And this is the same place that God came to Moses in the burning bush. That was on Mount Sinai. And He said, He told Moses that day, you will come back here. You will worship Me. So they are on their way back to Mount Sinai. They're in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. Now, other than just going to Mount Sinai, there are several possible reasons that God may have taken them this direction. Depending on the dating that is used, it could have been to provide a clear path for the Hyksos invasion of Egypt. As we talked about before, God may very well have not only brought the economic and social and religious structure of Egypt crashing down in the 10 plagues, He may have gone so far as to turn the masters into slaves. We do know that the Hyksos came into Egypt for inexplicable reasons, conquered the nation without a fight. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about the fact that the entire Egyptian army just drowned in the Red Sea. You know, you don't send part of your army out or a small number of your army out to get 2 million people. You're going to send a lot of your army out. And they were destroyed in the Egyptian Sea. Maybe that's the reason why. Some cite that there were more water sources in the south than the desert to the north. Of course, I don't really worry about that one too much, because most of the time the water source isn't a water source that was already there, is it? It's Moses going out and striking a rock or speaking to a rock and water coming from it. So God can make water sources in any direction that they may have gone. Some say as well that the Egyptians did not rule in the south as they did in the north. The Egyptians, the route north was their route into the rest of the world. They ruled it. They had forts. So maybe that was part of it, to simply remove them from the Egyptians. Then also, it is considered, and you know, as you read it, you wonder how, that there is a more comfortable climate in the south than there was in the north. They're going to spend a good bit of time here in the Sinai Peninsula. You know, all the reasons for the long and circuitous route are only known to God, but we should simply have faith that they were good reasons. Because, first and foremost of all, they are God's reasons as to why they took the long way around. You know, maybe they had my GPS, right? Have y'all had your GPS and put in something? Jenny put in something on GPS in a parking lot, and she got out, and it took her 1 mile around and brought her to the parking lot across the street. So maybe it was that. Maybe they just had a really wild GPS. I don't know. Well, it took 50 days for Israel to arrive at Mount Sinai after crossing the Red Sea. They crossed the Red Sea, and 50 days later, or 50 days from the time that they were delivered from Egypt, rather, they arrived at Mount Sinai. During this time, God leads them by a pillar of cloud during the day, and He leads them by fire, a pillar of fire at night. The Israelites also arrived at a source of water immediately after crossing the Red Sea. They moved just a little bit, came to a source of water that was well known, but when they got there, the water was bitter. And we see, other than when you talk about the people whining and crying on the other side of the Red Sea about, you know, the Egyptians coming, You see, a recurring pattern began right here of the Israelites grumbling about God and making a statement that they're going to make over and over and over again until God grants them the wish. God brought us out here to simply let us die. And that's what they say here. They grumble to Moses. They grumble about God. We're thirsty. We don't have any water. The water's bitter. And so Moses chops down a tree and he places it in the water and it becomes sweet. You know, time and time and time again, all that they're grumbling, God does try to meet their desires, what they want. He tries to do what they are grumbling about. But there comes a point where God says, that's enough. I mean, he understands and he gives them a certain amount of leeway because they are a pagan and unfaithful people at this particular point. I'm not sure that's ever going to change, at least from what we see in the Old Testament. Well, they continue on 7 more miles down the road to a place called Elim, and there were date trees and 12 springs of water. And the people once again grumbled, saying, when we were in Egypt, and we need to remind ourselves here that when they say when we were in Egypt, they were in Egypt being worked to death as slaves. That's the little bit they leave out, right? Isn't it amazing how sometimes all we can see is the bad? They go, when we were in Egypt, we had bread to eat, we had pots full of meat, and here we are out here now, and we got none of that. So they kind of forgot the other part of their day besides the times when they were eating, what the Egyptians were doing to them. And so God, at this particular point in their journey, He provides for them food. But they also accused God of bringing them again to the desert to die. God provided them manna in the morning on the ground. When the dew dried up, manna was laying there on the ground. I mean, God really makes it easy on these people. We have to go to the grocery store, right? All they had to do is walk out in their front yard and pick it up. And it only had that one rule, right? That only take what you can eat that day. Don't try to keep any. You know, there's a part of my mind that thinks almost every Israelite probably tried keeping one bowl full for one night. I just feel that in my heart. Just seeing the way that these people were. But you know, if you tried to keep it overnight, when it came out the next morning, it was spoiled and it was full of worms. It was very nasty if you tried to keep it overnight. But manna was provided every single morning. There was no reason to get more than you needed for a day. God also provided them meat in the form of quail in the evenings. And so He provided for them. He gave them meat. He gave them bread. The very things that they said they had in Egypt that they didn't have now. God established a Sabbath day, a day of rest, which was a remembrance of God's resting on the seventh day. But and we need to understand, I even hear members of the church go, you know, Sunday's our Sabbath. No, it's not. Sabbath is Saturday. Not unless Sunday somehow magically jumps to the seventh day of the week. Sabbath day was the seventh day. And it was to remember God's creating of the world and His resting on the seventh day. They were to work 6 days and to rest on the seventh day. And they were to be reminded. And the reason being, God wanted them to remember who created it all. Remember who's number one. Remember who is the reason for you being here. That's a good thing to remember, right? Every Lord's Day we partake of the Lord's Supper. They did that weekly. We do this weekly. We partake of the Lord's Supper to remember the one that made it possible for us to be here, right? The author and finisher of our salvation, Jesus Christ. So it's very similar in the memorials that are set forth between Sabbath and what we partake of in the Lord's Supper as we remember God. The Israelites then traveled to a place called Rephidim. In the middle of the wilderness of sin, I've always found that an interesting wilderness of sin, and these people certainly live up to that name. Once again, the people grumbled about not having water to the point that they even threatened to stone Moses. You get us some water. I mean, they were ready to kill him. They were ready to kill Moses. You know, it amazes me how short memories they have, right? This is the man that just defeated the whole nation of Egypt, and you're going to go stone him? This is the man whose staff turned water to blood, brought locusts on the land, brought darkness, brought all kinds of terrible things upon the most powerful nation of the world, and yet you think you can do something about him? They were angry. So Moses goes out and to a rock that God has appointed, and he strikes the rock. And water comes from it. God once again provides for this ungrateful, griping, grumbling people. I'll be honest with you. They wouldn't have never made it to Sinai if I was God. Because I can't stand griping and grumbling and whining and complaining. It just drives me nuts. If you want to just get on my last nerve, just whine and complain and gripe. You know what they say about people that whine and gripe, right? 90% don't care, and 10% are glad it's happening to you. So, you know, be careful about whining and griping and complaining. But that's exactly what they hear. They're ungrateful to God. They can't remember anything that He's done for them. They can only remember what they're not getting right now. They're like spoiled children. So they're just going to gripe and they're going to complain and they're going to whine and hopefully get what they want. Well, while at Rephidim, the Amalekites attack. One of my favorite stories in this whole series of events. Joshua gathers the army together and he goes out to fight the Amalekites, and Moses and Aaron and a man named Hur get on the hilltop above the battlefield, and the battle's going, and as long as Moses is holding his staff, right? The Israelites are winning, but when the staff comes down, they begin to lose. When he gets it back up, they begin to win. And it's back and forth just based on where Moses is holding his staff. So literally, Aaron and Hur set Moses down on a rock because he's getting tired. They set him down on a rock and they hold his arms for him, just keep his staff up. And they win the day. Great story. I love it. Something showing that it wasn't the valor of the Israelite men fighting in the battle, but it was God giving them the victory. How many times is God going to do that, right? Jericho, He's going to make it clear it wasn't your victory, it was mine. I will drive the people before you. God was always the source of their victories. Then we see a visit by Jethro just shortly before they get to Sinai. Jethro is Moses' father-in-law, and he comes, he spends some time with Moses, and he realizes that Moses is spending from daybreak to sundown judging the people, doing all, you know, you got 2 million people here that need judgments made and things of that nature, and they're all coming to Moses, and Jethro says, you can't keep this up. You're going to burn out, as we would say today. You got to come up with a better system than this. You're only one man. And so he, by the advice of his father-in-law, set up judges over thousands, over hundreds, over fifties, and over tens. And kind of set up exactly what we have today in our court system, right? The initial court you go to, and then appeals, and you eventually get all the way up to Moses if needs be. But if things can be settled before him, then they were. He would be, I guess, what we would coin the Supreme Court. He would make the final decision, anything that needed to go that high. Well, they arrived at Sinai, and they would remain there for 11 months. And during that 11 months, they would build the tabernacle. They would build its furnishings. And they would establish the practices of the law of Moses that were given by God on Mount Sinai. Well, this arrival at Sinai is believed to have coincided with the New Testament day of Pentecost. Pentecost is also known in the Bible, and specifically in the Old Testament, the Feast of Weeks. We see that in Exodus 34:22, because it was 7 weeks after the Passover, according to Leviticus 23:15. We also see it termed as the Feast of Harvest in Exodus 23:16, because it celebrated the conclusion of the barley harvest. It is called the Day of First Fruits in Exodus 23:16, and Exodus 34:22, because they offered the first fruits from that harvest. Well, this day occurred 50 days after Passover. That's what the word Pentecost means, 50. 50 days after the Passover was when this day came. We know that the day of Pentecost was on a Sunday because the Passover was on a Saturday. 49 days plus one put you on a Sunday. And so 7 weeks plus one, and you have the fact that Peter preached that sermon on a Sunday. Well, the Israelites arrive at Mount Sinai, and it is a mountain about 6,500 feet high. Would have had a gorgeous view of the valley where the Israelites would have been camping. And on this day, there begins a series of events that establishes the law of Moses. The people consecrate themselves first by command of God and wash their garments, and they prepared for God to descend upon the mountain on the third day. And Moses brings them all out, and they're standing there at the foot of the mountain, before the mountain of God, waiting for God, and He comes down. On the third day, a thick cloud descends upon the mountain with lightning flashes and thunder, and there was a sound, a very loud sound, like a trumpet. It just kept getting louder and louder and louder. The Israelites trembled at these. Folks, let me tell you what. Anytime you came into the presence of God, it wasn't something you forgot. You know, if Folks, when we go to God in prayer, we need to do so humbly and reverently. I've heard some prayers that I wondered about the reverence side of it. You know, an old preacher once said, we don't talk to God like we talk to Joe down on the street. He's God. Let me tell you what, these people came into the presence of God and they trembled. They feared. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 through 21 says that even Moses said, he said this, I am trembling with fear. That's Moses. This man's already spoke to God at the burning bush. He's already worked all these magnificent powers, but what took place there at Sinai scared Moses to death. It was a frightening thing. I'm trembling with fear. God Himself spoke there that day to the people, and He gave them the Ten Commandments. You know, we often think that they learned the Ten Commandments when Moses brought down the stones, right, with them written on them. No, that's not when they learned them. They learned them when God spoke them to them right now. The writing it on stone was just kind of a formality later. But God tells them the law. He lays down those, as they call them, the Ten Words. Ten Commandments are found in Exodus chapter 20. The first four deals with our people's duties, the Israelites' duties to God. And the last six dealt with their duties to each other, how they were to treat others. These commandments were designed to protect the people. Let me give you an example. We'll go through the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. That is protection from false gods. God wanted to protect them from what false gods would bring to their life. And that is His punishment. That is His wrath. That which we see in the book of Judges, that which we see in the 40 years of wandering, that which we see in the nation of Israel, both united and divided. The very things that would end up causing both of them to be carried into captivity. God wanted to protect them from that with the first commandment. Then we see, you shall not make for yourself an idol. You shall not worship them. Protection from false worship. See, you've got to remember, that's God and His great foreknowledge about Jeroboam. Jeroboam built those golden calves to worship God. You weren't worshiping a pagan god. He wanted to worship God through that, but that was false worship. That wasn't the way God wanted to be worshiped. So He tried to protect them from false worship. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That's protection from misusing God's name. God is so much greater than we are that to misuse His name is a terrible thing. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. A protection of the rest and the remembrance that God is Creator. To protect that memorial that is to constantly remind you where you are in the grand scheme of things, that God is there and I am here. He is God. Honor your father and your mother, the protection of parents. You shall not murder, the protection of human life. You shall not commit adultery, protection of marriage and personal purity. You shall not steal, protection of property. You shall not bear false witness, protection of truth. And you shall not covet, protection of the heart. Because you know, stealing, adultery, all of those things begin by coveting it, right? Wanting it, desiring it. Wanting idols. All of these, that one is kind of the sum up one. To protect your heart. After God spoke to the people, they begged. I love this. God speaks to them. He tells them the Ten Commandments. And the people beg God, don't speak to us anymore. We don't want you to talk to us anymore. Yeah, talk to Moses and let him come talk to us. But we don't want to hear you talk to us anymore lest we die. You think this is quite an experience? You think hearing the voice of God was something? You know, we talked about before about Elijah and the small voice, right? And the whisper. But I don't think God was whispering this day. I don't think He was whispering around the thunder and the lightning and the earth shaking. They were so afraid of God. And the people were told to remember that fear. Remember what happened here today. Remember how you were afraid. Remember the God that you stood before today so that you might obey Him. But the problem is they promptly forgot, didn't they? Just like they promptly forgot what God did to deliver them. Just like they promptly forgot how He's always provided for them. Just like they promptly forgot about Him on every turn. It doesn't take them long Really, it doesn't take them very long. Within 40 days, they're going to completely forget what God said. Moses then ascended the mountain and was on that mountain with God for 40 days. And one can say, you can take the people out of Egypt, right? But you can't necessarily take the Egypt out of the people, can you? So there's a goddess of fertility named Hathor in Egyptian religion. She is in the form of a cow. When they make that golden calf that day, they are worshiping that which they know well. They know Egyptian paganism probably better than they know God. But yet they should have remembered that God dismantled every one of those gods when He brought the 10 plagues. You know, Aaron tried to put a God spin on it. And put it like that. He tried to put a God spin on it. You know, Aaron, I don't know about Aaron. I try to figure him out. Because he's a different one, isn't he? Here is the guy that's going to be high priest, and he's going to tell Moses that they gave me their gold, I threw it in the fire, and this calf jumped out. Okay, yeah. Moses, you know, he may have been born yesterday, but it was in town. And so, you know, I think he was going to figure that one out. And so, you know, Aaron does that. But Aaron also tries to put a little God spin on this pagan thing because he puts an altar there basically to offer offerings to God in the presence of this idol. And he declares a celebration day for God. So he tries to put the God spin on it. Just like Jeroboam did, right? I've got a golden calf, but it's still really about God. But it's not. Because you know the echoes of God's voice saying, "You shall not make for yourself an idol." One that said that not to be in my presence. The echo of his voice had not long left that valley, and they're building a golden calf. God said, I don't want them in my presence. I don't want them, that literally means before me. I don't want to look down and see them. And yet here it is. Just that quick. No other gods before me. God on the mountain. I love the change in language. He tells Moses, your people. Remember, all these other times have been my people. My people are crying out. My people won't deliver. Now they're your people, Moses. That's like when your children obey, they're your child. And when they're disobeying, they're your wife's child, right? And I mean, that's exactly what you get from God here. Your people, Moses, are down there sinning. He said, I'm going to kill them all. I'm going to destroy every single one of them. You know, Moses prays to God and gets him to relent. And he even says, if you're going to destroy them, take me out of your book too. Literally willing to give up his salvation to save those people. And I don't understand that. But maybe it's an understanding, isn't it, about why Christ is called a prophet like Moses. Willing to give up himself to save the people. Which is what he does that day. Moses is a powerful, powerful character that had to deal with some very, very ornery people. Well, Moses prayed, and he prayed to God. He asked Him, begged Him not to do it. He said, the Egyptians will say, you just brought him out here to kill him. And God repents of what He's going to do, but Moses has got to go down and deal with them still. And Joshua was partway up the mountain. He had been given permission to come up a particular distance. Joshua was kind of Moses' right-hand man, kind of the person that took care of him and took care of things for him. And Joshua's sitting there. He goes, sounds like war down in the camp. You think they're having a pretty good celebration? Joshua says, it sounds like war. Quite a ruckus. Moses said, there ain't no war. About to be. There ain't one right now. Moses goes down, he takes the golden calf, he grinds it up, he burns it down, he grinds it up. It was probably wood with a thin layer of gold on it. And he burns it down and he grinds it up. He puts it in their drinking water. Let me tell you, we're in the middle of the desert. That's all the drinking water they have. So they're forced to drink it. And it's tainted with gold powder. Going to make them sick. And then Moses calls those that are on God's side to him. Who's on the Lord's side? And the Levites come to him and they go from gate to gate, from entrance to entrance of the camp, and they kill 3,000 people, 3,000 men as a result of this transgression. Somebody had to pay the price of a just God. Moses came down. We know that he broke the stone tablets that God had wrote. Literally, God wrote these himself. The ones that will be the replacements will not be written by God. They will be written by Moses. But God had written these and they are broken. You know, there are a number of similarities between the events at Sinai and what took place on Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. And I told you we arrived here at Sinai at about that time, most believe at that time. You know, in these days, as we compare these 2 days, both were a day when God was initiating a covenant between Himself and His people, right? God was initiating a covenant with the Israelite people here. God was initiating a covenant with all mankind in Acts chapter 2. Exodus, it was the law of Moses to a very select group, but yet the gospel was to everyone. God manifested His presence on both occasions with wondrous signs that were audible and visual, right? We had the cloud that came down on the mountain. We have lightning. We have thunder. We have the sound of a trumpet. We have God Himself speaking. It was powerful. There was no doubt that that what was taking place that day was from God. In Acts chapter 2, we see the signs there. You know, He got the people's attention with the sound as of a rushing mighty wind, right? Very audible, very obvious. Tongues like fire were above their heads, pointing it out. Visual, who to look at? Who are you looking for? And then they spoke, and every man heard in his own language. And the people that day understood that what was going on was something from God, right? And they listened. 3,000 obeyed the gospel. Neither occasion was missed. Both occasions were clear. They had uniquely similar events. When the law was given, 3,000 died in Exodus chapter 32 and verse 28. When the gospel was preached, 3,000 found life by being born again. The difference between those two laws. One brings death and one brought life. When the law was given, the people feared in Exodus 19:16. When the gospel was preached in Acts chapter 2 and verse 46, people rejoiced. The Ethiopian rejoiced. It is a time to rejoice when we are born again. It is also a day of first fruits for Pentecost or for the Jewish holiday. It was first fruits from their field. For Acts chapter 2, it was first fruits of the gospel. Those things that Hebrews chapter 12 is talking about when it said that Jesus was willing to endure the cross for the joy that lay before Him. And the joy that lay before Him was those fruits, the fruits of His efforts, saved people. That's what makes the cross worth it to Jesus Christ. Every saved person, every individual that is born again into Him. You know, there were in both cases, there was a 50-day waiting period between slavery in Egypt and the giving of the law of Moses. There was a 50-day waiting period as well between the end of the Old Covenant that happened at the death of Jesus Christ, according to Colossians chapter 2 and verse 14, and the revelation of the New Covenant in Acts chapter 2. You know, you can compare that to the time between the time that a person dies and their will is read, right? You can't go get what's yours in the will until the will is read. Once the will is read, it's there for you to take hold of and to have in your life. You know, when I read these things, my belief that God authored the Bible, every single word, is only built up when I see all these correlations that play that only God could do. That only God could lay out in His great divine plan. Now, may we remember from this that we should fear God. You know, like the Israelites, we need to fear God and allow that fear to remind us that we serve a great, powerful God. God that one day, when Jesus Christ returns, that event will be so great, so incredible, that every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess. Because He's God. He has that effect on people. Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah came into the presence of God and he said, oh, I'm a man of unclean lips and I live among a people of unclean lips, right? I'm immediately going to understand I'm not worthy to stand before him. I'm nothing. May that fear remind us to obey him. Obey his commandments to the letter, lest we find ourselves in a situation where, as the writer of Hebrews wrote about those that did not obey the commandments of God, that it is a fearful thing to fall into his hands in that condition. For wrath is all you will know. Fearing God and keeping his commandments is the entire duty in this life, according to Solomon. That is what you're here for. You're not here to make money. You're not here to be successful. You're not here to have a monument built to you. You're not here to be a hero. You're here to fear God and to keep his commandments. And that's it. Everything else falls in line after that. But you do that first. I believe that most unfaithfulness among Christians is as a result of a lack of appropriate fear of a righteous and holy God that cannot and will not accept spiritual and religious mediocrity. He never has. And he never will. And I think so many Christians think, well, I come to church and it really doesn't matter if I don't do the other things. It really doesn't matter if I don't dedicate my life to him. And they don't fear the fact that they're not doing what he says to do. That's why I say I think most unfaithfulness is due to a lack of fear. I've heard people say, I know I'm going to hell. You know what? That only means one thing. You either don't believe in hell or you don't fear it. And both would be a matter of ignorance. But if you properly fear God, you put him in his place of where he's at, I promise you, you're going to do everything he says. If those people had remembered, chosen to remember the God that spoke to them to where the point that they said, don't speak to us anymore. They'd have chosen to remember that. Exodus would have been a very different book. Deuteronomy would have been a very different book. The nation of Israel may have very well been a very different story. But it wasn't. Why? Because they didn't fear God and keep his commandments. This evening, if you have not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, we hope and pray that you will, that you will come to God and obey his commandments, to believe in him, repent of your sins, confess Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and be buried in baptism, raised to walk a new life, a life freed from sin, just as the Israelites were freed from slavery. You'll be freed from sin, and you'll be able to go forth to obey his commandments, always in fear that you serve such a wonderful and awesome God. If you're a child of God, maybe you haven't feared him. Maybe you've forgotten who you serve. Once again, know the fear of God that will drive you to obey his commandments. This evening, if we can assist you in any way, won't you come as we stand, as we sing.